Hello and welcome to the Movement to Restore Voting Rights Conference. My name is Brandon and I'll be your operator for today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session during which you can dial star 1 if you have a question. Please note this conference is being recorded and I will now turn it over to Kimberly Hall. You may begin.
Good afternoon and thank you, Brandon, for the introduction. I'm Kimberly Hall, Senior Communications Manager at Campaign Legal Center. And thank you all for joining us today to discuss the movement to restore voting rights. In the United States, up to 17 million Americans with prior convictions could register to vote today. Many more are eligible to restore their right to vote through an application process. However, millions are confused about whether they have the right to vote or can have their rights restored because of unnecessarily complicated and opaque felony disenfranchisement laws. Every state except Maine and Vermont has some form of voting restriction on people with past felony convictions, but only a handful of states permanently disenfranchise people with convictions. Felony disenfranchisement laws vary widely by state, and the restoration process is often difficult or confusing. Even in states with less restrictive laws, many people remain unaware of their rights, as states often make no attempt to educate citizens with past felony convictions on their ability to vote after they have paid their debt to society. Today, we'll hear from policy experts and activists working on felony disenfranchisement around the country. Please note that a recording of this call will be available on the Campaign Legal Center website and will be emailed to you within 48 hours of the call. Now, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Nicole Porter, Director of Advocacy at the Citizen Project, where she manages state and local advocacy efforts on citizen reform, voting rights, and eliminating racial disparities in the criminal justice system. Nicole?
Thank you, Kim. And I want to thank the Campaign Legal Center for inviting me to participate in this important discussion this afternoon. As of 2016, more than 6 million American residents were excluded from voting because of a felony conviction. The number of persons disenfranchised has increased substantially, along with the rise of the nation's criminal justice population in recent years, rising from an estimated 1.17 million in 1976 to 3.34 million in 1996 to 6.1 million in 2016. The majority of disenfranchised persons live in the community. In fact, 77% of disenfranchised voters live in their communities. They pay taxes, they're expected to be good residents, expected to support their families, but they also live under felony probation or parole supervision and have not completed their full sentence. Many have completed their full sentence and are also disenfranchised in some states for life. Specifically, an estimated 3.1 million residents are disenfranchised due to state laws that restrict voting rights even after the completion of their sentence. The United States remains one of the world's strictest nations when it comes to denying the right to vote to residents convicted of crimes. As I've mentioned, an estimated 6.1 million are forbidden to vote because of what we call felony disenfranchisement or laws restricting voting rights for those convicted of felony-level crimes. Rates of disenfranchisement vary dramatically by state due to broad differences that Kimberly has already hinted at in voting exclusions for persons with a felony conviction history in six states: Alabama, Florida, Kentucky, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Virginia. More than 7% of the adult population is disenfranchised. In two states, Maine and Vermont, individuals never lose their right to vote. They're never disenfranchised due to a felony conviction. And in fact, persons in prison can vote each election cycle. And there is active work right now in these states of Maine and Vermont where state advocates are working with correctional officials to ensure the franchise for incarcerated residents leading up to Election Day in November. Felony disenfranchisement has a long history in the United States. Settlers brought the practice with them as they established early colonial laws, and the practice was reinforced as part of the post-Reconstruction period when several southern states tailored their disenfranchisement laws following the Civil War in order to bar blackmail residents from voting, targeting offenses specifically believed to be committed most frequently by the black population. One of the best-known examples is in Mississippi, where party leaders called for disenfranchisement for offenses such as burglary, theft, arson, but not for robbery or murder. Similar histories dominate the constitutional conventions of Alabama, Virginia, and other states. Interestingly, callers might want to know that how the United States compares internationally. Almost half of European countries allow all incarcerated individuals the right to vote, facilitating voting within prison or by absentee ballot. And yet today in the United States, because of these felony disenfranchisement laws, these racially disparate laws, one in 13 black residents of voting age is disenfranchised, a rate that is more than four times greater than that of non-African-American residents. Over 7.4% of the adult African-American population is disenfranchised, compared to 1.8% of non-black residents. In four states, Florida, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia, more than one in five black adults was disenfranchised as of 2016. There have been reforms, and I'm excited to hear where efforts are from my co-panelists this afternoon. And since 1997, the Sentencing Project has documented 24 states that have modified or repealed felony disenfranchisement exclusions to expand voter eligibility and or inform persons with felony convictions of their right to vote, either through legislative or executive action. We've documented since the late 90s that nine states, including Texas, Rhode Island, and Maryland, either repealed or amended their lifetime disenfranchisement laws. Four states expanded voting rights to persons in the community under felony probation or parole supervision. Those states include Connecticut, California, and New York, among others. 10 states eased the restoration process for persons seeking to have their right to vote restored after the completion of their sentence. And three states improved data and information sharing so that residents with the felony conviction history know of their right to vote. And this is so important given the general narrative that dominates this conversation and a lot of misinformation that residents and even election practitioners have internalized, thereby making it difficult for residents, justice-involved residents with a prior felony conviction history to vote and register and participate in the franchise. Due to these successful reforms between 1997 and 2016, we at the Sentencing Project estimate that 840,000 residents have regained the right to vote. And as a point of advocacy, the involvement in these campaigns, the organizing of these campaigns has helped to politicize a constituency of justice-involved residents that have gone on to be involved in robust efforts around prison population reductions, and that have helped to reimagine and reorient the punitiveness that dominates criminal justice policy in the United States into a more restorative and rehabilitative process. And so that's very exciting. And I would say that felony enfranchisement reforms and the organizing that campaigns that spur them have helped to initiate and inspire that activism. As we head into the elections this November, there continues to be a great deal of opportunity to raise awareness around felony disenfranchisement and expand the franchise to persons detained in pretrial in county and local jails around the country. And I know we're going to hear from Darrell in Houston to talk more about that. But there are also active efforts to expand voting rights to incarcerated persons in New Jersey, Hawaii, Massachusetts, and California. And I'll wrap up there and look forward to hearing and learning from my co-presenters and also engaging in the Q&A portion of the call this afternoon. Thank you again for inviting me to participate.
Thank you, Nicole. Please remember that we'll take all of our questions after we hear from all of today's speakers. And I would now like to welcome Blair Bowie to discuss legal efforts in the field, and RestoreYourVote.org, the online resource to help individuals seeking more information on restoring their rights.
Hi, my name is Blair Bowie. I'm a Skadden Fellow here at Campaign Legal Center. So we just heard a little bit about the problem of the 6 million people who are directly disenfranchised, and a problem that is frequently less talked about, but that Nicole mentioned, is that there's an estimated 23 million Americans with past felony convictions, and while 6 million of those are directly disenfranchised by felony disenfranchisement laws, of those other 17 million, there are a lot of people who do not vote because they do not understand that they have the right to vote. They think that they can't vote because of a lack of information. And really, it's understandable. These laws are really confusing. Every state is different. In some states, whether you've lost your right to vote or whether you can get it back depends on the interplay of many, many factors. For example, whether you've finished probation or parole, whether you've paid off your fines and fees, whether you've paid your child support, whether you're current on your child support, the year of your conviction, the year of the completion of your sentence, the number of years since your completion of your sentence, number of past convictions, whether multiple convictions were related, the category of conviction, that list goes on and on. So understanding these laws can be really confusing just from the get-go. Moreover, these laws are really burdensome. Even if you understand where your rights are in the law, you might have a really hard time exercising your right to vote. Many states still require that you pay off fines and fees before you can go through a process of restoring your vote. That's a modern-day poll tax. Moreover, the process for rights restoration in the states that have rights restoration processes are frequently opaque and time-consuming. For example, we've been doing a lot of work in Nevada, where there is a petition process for many people to restore their right to vote if they've been dishonorably discharged from parole or probation or had multiple felony convictions or had certain categories of convictions. They will need to go through a petition process. But because that process is so hard to understand, there are very few people who have ever done it, and no one really knows how to do it. The Sentencing Project estimated that only 280 people restored their voting rights through that process in a 20-year period. I went in person to the clerk of court's office in Las Vegas to ask about the process, and no one there had even heard of it. And that leads a lot of people to believe that they might need a lawyer to go through this process, which is another financial barrier. Some states even require that people provide paperwork to prove that they can vote, even where those states claim that they have automatic voter restoration once people have completed their sentence. They require documentation that people have completed their sentence, which many people don't have, creating an additional bureaucratic hurdle to provide information that the state already has. So those laws are really burdensome. Furthermore, states aren't doing enough to educate people about how their laws work. For example, in 2017, Alabama passed a new law that would effectively re-enfranchise about probably half of the disenfranchised 285,000 people, but they openly said that they were going to spend no state resources on educating people about it. And those are people who have actually been wrongly told that they can't vote by the state. The state is not informing them that they have the right to vote. Some states go beyond just a lack of public information. Some states are actively misinforming people. We've identified 11 states, as well as the Election Assistance Commission, that have incorrect or incomplete information about eligibility to vote after a felony conviction on their voter registration forms. Other states have confusing or incomplete information on their websites. And we found in many states that the registrars are actually confused about how to enforce the law because even they don't have enough information. So laws are being enforced differently from county to county. Finally, and worst of all, some states are actively intimidating and suppressing the vote by prosecuting people who, after all this confusion, accidentally vote. For example, Crystal Mason in Texas and the Alamance 12 in North Carolina. Knowing how confusing, burdensome these laws are and how little states are doing to inform people and how states are actually putting out misinformation, it's obvious that those prosecutions are a very cynical voter suppression tactic that do nothing to improve the integrity of elections, which could be done with simple efforts towards public education. So what's the solution? I think there's really three legs to the solution. There's legislation, changing these laws, litigation, another way of changing these laws, or at least making sure that they're enforced properly, and doing organizing work in communities to help people understand their rights. You're definitely going to hear about the legislation angle when we talk about Florida later, but I'll talk a little bit now about the organizing work to do outreach and education and the how that interplays with a litigation strategy. So on the outreach and education front, we are working in three states, have organizers on the ground in three states. In Alabama, we're partnered with the Southern Poverty Law Center on the Alabama Voting Rights Project. We have three organizers there, and then two organizers in Nevada and two in Arizona. And then we're partnering and supporting Houston Justice and other groups doing this work. So there's really three buckets of tactics in this organizing strategy. The first is direct services. So that means getting out and finding people with past convictions and educating them about their rights, walking them through the process, helping them with paperwork. To do that, we canvass. We go door to door. We stand on the streets. We set up tables at libraries, community meals, community events. We go to reentry centers. We hold clinics. And so far, we've helped over 1,000 people individually understand their voting rights. 868 in Alabama as of today, 161 in Arizona, and 127 in Nevada. The next sort of bucket of tactics is community empowerment. We know we can't reach everyone who's disenfranchised to provide them with that help, but we can train activists and community leaders in states with confusing laws so that they understand the law and then can help other people in their community. In Alabama, we've trained almost 900 people through workshops. We've done trainings for people who frequently interact with people who might have a higher potential for having past convictions or for having involvement with the criminal justice system. For example, we've trained the network of librarians in Tuscaloosa and Birmingham who are frequently helping people register to vote. And we've trained a network of healthcare providers across the state of Alabama who serve low-income communities and wanted to add rights restoration to their standard intake. And then the last bucket of tactics is just really wholesale public education. We need to debunk the myth that a felony conviction means you can never vote again. And that's in large part what RestoreYourVote.org is about. This is a website we launched last month that has information about the voting laws in all 50 states, and anyone who has a conviction can go on there and just answer a series of simple yes or no questions to figure out where their voting rights stand and what sort of paperwork they need to fill out to get their voting rights back or whether they can just register to vote right now. We've had over 5,000 visitors to the site, and it's just a really important tool for making sure that people understand how their voting rights work. So I'll just quickly wrap it up by saying that this strategy doesn't work alone. These laws need to be changed. These laws need to be challenged. And we are working on challenging laws that create these barriers to voting in the first place, like the one in Alabama, and also pushing back on uneven or improper enforcement of the laws. And being on the ground, having organizers out in the community, talking to people, helping people get through the system, helps us identify the problems in implementation, and then we can advocate to make changes in the application that open more doors and make it easier for people to understand their rights or have them restored, which creates more demand for organizing. So those strategies really work together, and I will leave it there.
Thank you, Blair. Now we hear from representatives from the local and state levels working in their communities to help people restore their right to vote. First, we have Darrell Douglas, who, after a five-year stint as a prison guard, dedicated the remainder of his life towards creating a world where fewer people who came from the neighborhoods like his ended up behind bars. He now serves as the president and founder of Houston Justice.
Thank you so much. Darrell Douglas with Houston Justice here in Houston, Texas. And our organization was founded in 2014. Basically a grassroots group of volunteers really adamant on making changes to the justice system at the local, and statewide level through not only the legislative end, also through advocacy and education. So late last year, we came up with what we call Project Orange, which was sort of this idea to go into the county jails. The county jail here in Houston, Harris County Jail, is the largest in the state. It has a population of 10,000, and they're hovering right at 100% capacity usually. But to go in and to register eligible voters. Through our initial work looking at the grand jury process, we sort of noticed this sort of the way that the bail system works here that caused so many from often disenfranchised communities to end up at the county jail longer than usual, sort of this debtor's prison, if you will. And we recognized there wasn't a mechanism for these people to register to vote or to vote, even though 7 out of 10 or 70% of those that are held in jail on any given day here in Harris County haven't even been actually convicted of a crime. They're there because they can't bail out. So, you know, we started with our first wave during the primaries where we were actually able to take volunteers into the county jail and register voters. Earlier this year, after the primary, the story of Crystal Mason really hit hard. That actually happened in Houston. Crystal Mason, who voted while on probation and was subsequently sentenced to 5 years in prison, that had a resounding impact on basically voter registration when you talk about disenfranchised communities. This coupled with the myth that those with felony convictions not being able to vote is probably really great contributing factors to the reason that Texas has sort of the bottom of the barrel when it comes to voter turnout. So, sorry about that. So, you know, after going through Project Orange and sort of getting to this understanding, the opportunity came up to actually target the formerly incarcerated through our work that we're teaming up with CLC Campaign Legal Center. And so since then, in addition to doing Project Orange, we're able to go out into the community. We're going to apartment complexes. We're going to barbershops and beauty shops. We're going to multi-service centers and the courthouses. We're talking to people on the ground and making sure that they know that they are eligible to be registered to vote. One guy, Art, I met with some volunteers. We were canvassing a couple of games ago, and Art served 14 years flat in TDCJ, Texas Department of Criminal Justice. He served his time flat, and while he was locked up, he was actually a barber inside the penitentiary. So luckily, he had a trade when he came out, and that's what he's doing today. So usually when we do these things, we'll go in, we'll ask, you know, is there a head barber and owner or sort of the barber manager, and give them the quick spill about what it is that we're doing and can we talk to the folks that are in the chair and the barbers. And usually they'll say yes. Same thing for beauty shops and other places. If you go in and explain what you're doing, they'll usually let you talk to folks. And so one lady was talking to another barber, basically explaining to him the whole thing, and Art, this guy who served 14 years flat, overheard her and sort of jumped in with, well, basically saying that he can't vote because he was convicted of a violent crime. And so I was able to jump in and say, well, that doesn't matter. Are you off paper, X, Y, Z? And he actually didn't believe me. He actually didn't believe that he could vote. So I bet him $5. I said I could look it up online. And if I'm right, you have to register, and you owe me $5 off my haircut. And if I'm wrong, then I owe you $5 in addition to my haircut. And obviously, I won. I didn't get $5 off my haircut, though. But the story with Art, who then signed up, he attended our – we had a VBVR training in the state of Texas. In order to register others to vote, there's an additional hurdle that you have to go over, which is basically attending a one-hour class, that's put on by the county tax office to be able to register to vote. He did that, and now he's one of the folks that are going to be in the community registering people that he interacts with every day. And that's sort of our model for really, you know, casting the net really wide and far. So far, including Project Orange the first time, we've registered a total of 731 folks to vote. A lot of what we've heard in the field, now that we've been able to do these sort of canvases on the weekend, is that, of course, you can get charged if you vote, and you're not supposed to, due to your conviction. A lot of people, we've heard that you have to wait 7 years after you've served your time before you can vote, or that you can't vote if you're behind on your child support, or that you can't vote if you're convicted of a 3G crime, a violent crime, or you can't vote if you have an open warrant, and none of those things are true. It's really shocking in the face-to-face interactions to see how often these things come up. Through our partnership with Campaign Legal Center, we're putting on 4 workshops or trainings for people like Art to really instill in them and to educate and empower them to be able to do the work on the ground to not only register but to educate others, as well as a town hall closer toward the deadline for voter registration here in Texas. And that's what we're doing with Houston Justice.
Thank you, Darrell. Let's see, our final speaker for today is Neil Volz from the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. The Florida Rights Restoration Coalition is a leader in the state voting rights restoration fight with a constitutional amendment on Florida's November 2018 ballot. Neil has more than 25 years of experience working as a public servant and community advocate. Neil.
Thank you, Kimberly. Really grateful to be on the call. Thanks for the Campaign Legal Center. And I really enjoyed listening to everybody's presentation. So, gosh, Nicole and Darrell and Blair and everybody, thank you for your presentations. We are at a really cool moment in Florida's history. We feel like we're in a historic moment, and we're 55 days away from an election that could ultimately restore the ability to vote for nearly 1.4 million people. And we know that we're doing, you know, that this has been a long walk. Like, this has been a long walk, and we're sitting on the shoulders of a lot of folks, a lot of organizations, people have come before us. So real quick, let me just tell you a little bit, if I could, about the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, who we are as an organization, and kind of where we come from. We're a grassroots membership organization, and we're run by returning citizens, formerly convicted people. And our goals are to end disenfranchisement and discrimination against people with convictions and create a more comprehensive and humane reentry system. And our goal is ultimately to help, you know, increase public safety, reduce recidivism, improve successful reentry, all those things that I think all of us agree on. But we are an organization that is built around returning citizens and for returning citizens, including myself. So I guess let me update you a little bit in terms of kind of where we are in Florida. And like I said, this comes from years of work and progress in other states and learning from what other people have done. And it also comes, obviously, from the pain of a lot of people in the state of Florida. According to the Centene Project, we have a 1.68 million people who are disenfranchised in our state, nearly 1.4 million who have paid back their entire debt and therefore, you know, would qualify under our ballot measure. In fact, here, let me pull up the ballot measure. What we have on the ballot this year is a very basic voting restoration amendment. And it reads, this amendment restores the voting rights of Floridians with felony convictions after they complete all terms of their sentence, including parole and probation. The amendment would not apply to those convicted of murder or sexual offenses who would continue to be permanently barred from voting unless the governor and cabinet vote to restore their voting rights on a case-by-case basis. So that is what people are going to be voting on in November, or actually starting to vote in early vote in October. and we feel really excited about where we are. This is truly a grassroots effort that put this on the ballot. I know I got plugged into this in 2015, and I'm relatively new still compared to a lot of people who have been a part of this movement. Maybe some of you folks who are listening, and if so, thanks for everything that you've done. Over time, we really gathered a whole lot of momentum behind this simple idea of that when the debt's paid, it's paid, and that really it's the people who are closest to the pain that need to be in the middle of this movement. Like, those are the two basic pillars that we, you know, have been operating under for years. That is, that returning citizens' families, those of us who know the pain and understand just how broken this process is. And in Florida, we have a wildly broken system, as was outlined by some of the other speakers. But we want to make sure that the stories and the experiences and the knowledge that those of us who have walked through this, that we're at the center of this movement. And what we've seen over time is that the momentum has really been built around the families of returning citizens. And that's been wild to see. The way our Florida process works is our first hurdle was to get to the Supreme Court, in which we needed 80,000 signatures to get to the Supreme Court, at which point the Supreme Court can then rule whether the language that I just read to you is constitutional or not. And this was an effort of people from all walks of life, from all over the state, and everybody who really rallied behind that common vision of, hey, when a debt's paid, it's paid. And we were very intentional about trying to assign a universal value, you know, to this movement so that we could get people from all walks of life to really rally around this. And we noticed how effective it was once we got to the court. Because once we got to the court decision, you realize where the people were signing petitions from, where the movement is most active, and the truth is it was everywhere. We had people in conservative-leaning communities who were on fire for this, and people in liberal-leaning communities who were on fire for this. And we really just began to see that this was an everybody issue. It wasn't an issue in which we needed to compartmentalize ourselves in ways that other campaigns sometimes have to. And so that really gave us the fire to keep moving forward in terms of one, getting to the court. So once we got to the court, it was really cool. It was a unanimous decision that our language was constitutional. And despite hearing constantly that people were going to oppose, you know, what is a very moral and universal value, you know, when you really cut this down to, you know, this idea that, you know, when your debt's paid, it's paid, nobody came out against it. And so that really fueled our efforts even more. And along the way, but really in that moment, the levee broke and we started to see a lot more support and people just kind of rallying behind this movement to get this on the ballot. And so, you know, and we're incredibly grateful for everybody, anybody who helped in that process. Ultimately, there were over 1.1 million signatures on ballots. And we had to get 766,000 of those certified. So with that information, you know, that became a real backbone of kind of our efforts to really cultivate this community, you know, the returning citizen community and those folks who are supportive of it. And so that's kind of been our basic blocking and tackling, has been to build out and communicate directly with the families of those who are most impacted by this. And we have done an incredible amount of public education and gotten into communities and mobilized in communities that don't typically aren't always engaged or sometimes engaged, but not always engaged. And one of the things at FRRC that we're very much focused on is making sure that we have returning citizens as much as possible going into communities and actually conducting the public education, actually conducting the conversations with people so that we can educate them about Amendment 4, about felon disenfranchisement, and, you know, what this kind of change could do. And that leads us back to, you know, our hopes and our goals is that this idea that if Florida can become a state that universally supports this idea of a debt being paid, you know, when a debt's paid, it's paid, we believe that will have real ramifications when it comes to things like housing policy. You know, why can't somebody live in a house? We thought that we believed when the debt's paid, it's paid. Why do we have to have these licensing requirements and restrictions on people who have felony convictions? We thought we all believed that when the debt's paid, it's paid. You know, so those are the kind of things that we're really excited about, you know, in terms of seeing where this movement goes. That being said, and I must say I've kind of lost track of where my time is, but we have 55 days. We're really focused on getting out, talking to people about Amendment 4. And so far, you know, all indications are that, you know, we've got some good public support. Our most recent polling had our support at over 70%. And in Florida, you actually have to get 60% of the vote. So this is not a simple majority. You actually have to show that you got broad support across the state. And as of right now, most recent polling has over 70% with 60% support across all demographics, men, women, Democrat, Republican, you know, northern state, southern state, the whole deal. And so we really are feeling optimistic right now that this message is getting across and that people are connecting with it in a way that hopefully come November, we might be able to add, you know, 1.4 million people to the 800-some thousand that was mentioned earlier. And we are grateful for everybody who's been a part of that. So you got me on here. I can ramble if you want longer, but that's kind of where, you know, where I was going to plan on ending.
Right. Thank you, Neil. As a reminder, a recording of this call will be emailed to you within 48 hours of the call, and it will also be available on CLC's website. We will now start our Q&A session with all of our participants from the call.
Thank you. We'll now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you'd like to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. There may be a delay before the first question is announced. If you're on a speakerphone, please pick up your handset first before dialing. Once again, if you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And we're standing by for any questions. And from Office of Human Rights, we have Joe Thornton. Please go ahead.
Yes. First, I want to thank the CLC for arranging this conversation, and definitely Nicole and everyone that has spoken. I just want to, again, my name is Charles Thornton, and I am from the Office on Human Rights in the District of Columbia. I'm also a directly impacted individual who spends a lot of time in prisons, and this issue is real dear to me. And I think that we definitely got to include the District of Columbia when we begin to talk about, you know, voting rights for individuals. D.C. never gets mentioned, and the laws were passed in D.C. back in 1980 that allowed individuals, as soon as they return back to the community from prison, whether they're on parole or probation, the right to vote. You know, that was done in 1980. And just so, you know, there's some education that has gone through along with once that was done. It wasn't until around 1990 that we really began to exercise that right. And I'm a grassroots guy myself, came up through advocacy and was involved in, you know, encouraging it and doing a lot of voter engagement outreach efforts with formerly incarcerated to educate them on their right to vote. And for all of the other, you know, states that are taking on these challenges now, I would say that there's a lot of history in the district, what it took to really get that message across. It's still an ongoing battle, but we do go into the jail, our local jail, as well as there's other legislation that's being introduced right now, D.C. Law 2294, which is part of what we call the Fair Elections Amendment Act, that will, you know, will put funds, government funds in place that will allow individuals to really run for office to help finance campaigns of some returning citizens who may want to run for office but does not have the economic, you know, access to make that kind of run. So just wanted to get that out there. Don't forget about D.C. And if there's anything I can do to support any of these efforts, I am available. Thanks.
Thank you. Once again, if you have a question or comment, please dial star 1. Okay, it looks like nothing further at the moment. So, speakers, we have nothing further at the moment. Any closing remarks?
This is Nicole. I'm at the Sentencing Project. I had a question, if there's no question from the audience. Can I ask my question?
Sure.
Great. I had a question for Darrell in Houston. I was really curious about the grassroots strategy. You talked about going into barbershops and community centers, the multi-service centers. I was just curious, Houston is such a large city. For people on the phone or just as part of this general conversation, since the recording will be posted from the Campaign Legal Services website, do you have guidance or suggestions for how community activists, grassroots activists who might, you know, be working in a large city such as Houston, where people should start at?
Absolutely. So in Houston, we have sort of these multi-service centers that are like city, you know, your local city multi-service center. And that's where a lot of, there's like the city health department, there's people come to sign up for TANF, there's like different senior programs and community programs. Those sort of become like hubs for activity in the different neighborhoods. So if you go, if you start there, a lot of times you end up meeting the people that'll connect you to the other spots, right? So we have this huge like Google Doc that sort of shows like where we'll be on each, you know, Saturday and Sunday. A lot of those things aren't places that we came up with. It's places that where we've met someone, right? Like for instance, there's a lady just yesterday that I met with. Who served time in the federal prison and in the state jail as well. And she's connected to, like, all the halfway houses, right? Because these are relationships that she sort of built. She's actually going to school to become a licensed chemical dependency counselor. Like, now she's ready to, you know, she served time and now she's going to be on the other side of service. And so she has a ton of links. And so, you know, usually it's meeting people and really talking to people, and they'll easily tell you sort of where to go.
That's great. And this is Nicole again. I have another question if there's no questions from the audience or other panelists this afternoon.
We do have a question from the audience. We'll take that real quick. From People's Action, we have Kiana Johnson. Please go ahead.
Hi, yes. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, this is Kiana Johnson. I have a couple organizations that I represent, including my own organization, Life After Release, but I'm doing community organizing with People's Action in Progressive Maryland here in Prince George's County. Maryland is one of the states where our rights have been restored. I'm formerly incarcerated as well. And our rights have been restored, but again, getting the education out and doing voter registration drives are kind of difficult. I'm getting some resistance at our county jail from the inmate director of inmate services, and you know, just trying to get in there to get the inmates registered is kind of difficult. So. Do you have any suggestions on how to apply pressure to make sure that we are getting the results that we need?
Absolutely. In Harris County, initially, the conversation started with a list of questions to them, basically asking, number one, if someone is incarcerated, you know, how are they able to vote? Like, what's the mechanism? Right. So once we asked, we basically started asking from that angle to where they kind of see like, whoa, we kind of need to deal with this thing, because if not, like, I mean, to put it point blank, if they were not going to cooperate, it was going to be a news story that 10,000, you know, 7 out of 10,000 people were being, you know, sort of held back from being able to vote because there's no the county didn't have a mechanism. So through that, they were kind of forced to work with us because if not, you know, we were going to, you know, take to the next step and point it out because all you really need is for one inmate who happens to be in the county jail for a traffic ticket, right, end up being there during that window and not being able to vote, that's a lawsuit, right? You have a governmental entity that would then be holding people back. I will say when we started having the conversations, we sort of laid out for them in a way that sort of took away what the liability for them would be. We kind of like dotted a lot of I's and crossed a lot of T's, like dealing with other governmental entities like, in Texas, it's the tax office. So working with the tax office to see, okay, what if, you know, like basically to figure out logistically how it should work. And we were able to make that work. And then the last thing that I would say, you have a lot of elected officials that may be on your side already or that you may have relationships with. Sort of getting them to do that ask is a whole lot stronger, too, because, you know, if you have a state rep or a state senator asking what the mechanism is at the county jail for people to vote, you know, they sort of get with it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, man, no further questions at the moment.
This is Nicole. I have another question, and this is for Blair and staff at the Campaign Legal Center. So, you know, Darrell just mentioned pressure that activists and organizers might leverage to pressure either the jail or election officials to ensure that directly impacted residents, you know, are assured of their voting rights leading up to an election cycle. I'm just curious what other sort of litigation strategies you all can suggest or provide guidance to local community organizers for particularly folks that you know, may not have resources to a civil rights law office in their community. How can they learn about litigation strategies and ways to apply that pressure?
Mm-hmm. So I think one thing that's really important to emphasize with people as you're out in community is finding people who need assistance, figuring out where their voting rights stand or getting through the process. As we just, you know, emphasize that they don't need a lawyer for that, but this gets back to sort of what I was saying earlier about how the organizing and litigation strategies really interplay together. As you are assisting people through the process of getting their rights back or just simply registering if you've realized that they have the right to vote, following up with those people and seeing how the process goes is really crucial to identifying ways that the law isn't being implemented correctly. So, for example, we've found in Alabama that some of the registrars aren't implementing the law correctly around out-of-state and federal convictions. And we only really know that when we help people initially, you know, we go through the process, determine that they have their voting rights, but then follow up with them and see what happened. And they'll say, you know, I heard back from the registrar that I couldn't register. And then we can sort of advocate for them and identify the problem. And if that can be dealt with through advocacy and trying to implement that in the other registrar's offices, that's great. If not, I think that litigation becomes something that people need to talk about to really push states on this. And I'll give you another example of a problem we were able to identify. I was reached out to by a man who lives in Tuscaloosa named Willie Mack, and he said that he had been told at the DMV that he could get registered to vote, but when he tried, it didn't go through. So I did a little bit of digging into his case and found that the state had actually incorrectly marked his conviction. So it looked as if it was a disqualifying conviction under Alabama law, but it was in fact not. And that just identified another problem in the state's whole system for figuring out who can vote and who can't. So things like that, I'd say, yeah, my advice to community organizers about how to deal with the strategy is to let the community organizing, let that guide where you go with the litigation strategy and bringing those to attorneys. And we are here and ready to help people either advocate for, you know, just advocate to get their rights as individuals, but also to look at that bigger picture of, okay, when do we need to do litigation? And the other way that that works is that the litigation strategies can open doors for more people to get their rights restored. In Alabama, there was a lot of grassroots work to reform their law for a really long time. The law had been vague and ambiguous for over 100 years about which criminal convictions disqualified people from voting. And there's been a lot of grassroots work around that. And then there was also an additional pressure on the state when Alabama citizens that we were representing pointed out that this was a problem and this was vague. And I think that those together helped move the legislature to pass the law that clarified which convictions disqualify people and therefore re-enfranchised probably around half of the people who were previously disenfranchised. That then creates an organizing opportunity. So they play together, and I think that the important thing is that there's open communication between the people on the ground and lawyers, and those don't have to be different people.
Okay, and we do have another question on the phone from Kentuckians for the Commonwealth. We have Dave Newton. Please go ahead.
Greetings. This is comments and update, and then a question. First of all, just deep thanks to everyone on this call. These case studies and various other like data points have been really valuable, and I really appreciate you all. Second, just really quick, we're trying to reinvigorate our campaign for restoration of voting rights in the state of Kentucky, one of the most restrictive states. We've really, over the past 15 years, I guess, built a network of former felons telling their stories and other folks, built a lot of support. But our legislature, whereas it seemed really close in early years, has just gotten farther and farther away from passing with a supermajority the constitutional amendment we need to really move things forward. So we're really focusing on voter registration, education, and mobilization of folks who can vote, in a lot of cases pushed forward by the voices of folks who can't vote, to try to change the makeup of our legislature to make this easier to move forward. Hopefully after November, you'll be hearing a lot more from us if we're able to move things enough to have like a viable campaign moving forward after that. But my question... this is something we've dedicated a lot of time to, unfortunately, over the years, but Kentucky is in an odd space as well with regard to folks in jail, but not convicted of the felony. And I heard some of y'all speak to that a little earlier. In Kentucky, of course, you're not disenfranchised for a misdemeanor, but so you can register and vote, with the exception that our absentee voter process has specific allowances for who can and who can't actually cast an absentee ballot, which would generally be your only choice from jail. Amongst this list is if you're away from your home county for work or for school, or if you're sick or have scheduled surgery, but not if you're in the jail. So whereas folks aren't legally disenfranchised in any way, they have the right to vote. They have no mechanism to vote. And I'm wondering if folks have any experience with overcoming that problem through legislation.
Well, this is Nicole. I don't know if folks from Campaign Legal Center or anyone else has some information to add, but there is an ongoing effort now in states to look at jails as a place for voting and ensure that folks who are detained on election day or during the early voting period are ensured of their right to vote and participate in the franchise. There's efforts right now in Illinois to ensure that Cook County, where Chicago is located, is a polling site, and the current legislation, which has to go through some final legislative hurdles before it becomes law, is there's some provisions in there to encourage other counties around the state to follow a similar practice. And in California, which is very complicated, we don't have time this afternoon to get into all the details, but there's in some ways a similar situation where there are people in county jail who actually have felony convictions, but because of how complicated California's criminal justice system is, because in efforts to try to deal with chronic overcrowding in the state's prison system, there are people held in jails that, with felony convictions, whose rights have been restored, and there are ongoing efforts in that state to ensure that those voting rights can happen in jail. So I just say that to let you know, and to let other folks on the phone know, that looking at jails as a place to protect voting rights and ensure that people codify that in the statute, and then also work intentionally with jailers and sheriffs to protect the rights of voting for people from the jail, is an ongoing area of activism and an opportunity for coalition building. In some way, Darrell spoke to that from his experience in Houston, and Charles Thornton spoke to that from his experience in the district, and there are other efforts to do that. But then to use state legislation as a way to codify that is sort of work that is happening. And there are more and more conversations that are getting sparked around that around the country, including what I've mentioned from Illinois and California. But these conversations are going to be unique. And I think looking at Kentucky in particular, I know that there would be some opportunity to have a longer conversation about that and figure out if there's an opportunity to support your work and address the policy issue that you're flagging in terms of the structural problem that's preventing people from actually voting absentee in the jail in Kentucky. And it might be a litigation strategy there as well.
And, hey, this is Neil from FRRC, man. I appreciate the question, and I appreciate the position you're in and kind of the general kind of topic that you brought up. I know you have some specific questions, but, man, just person to person, I'd like to encourage you. If there's anything we can do, anything we might have learned along the ways here, we got a long way to go, 50-some days, you know, still ahead of us, and we have a lot of work to do. But, man, we've fed off of other people from other states who would encourage us and kind of just be there, you know, in those moments, man. So I'm happy to have any conversation with you that you'd like, that maybe we can download any sort of lessons that we learned that might be helpful to you. I don't necessarily have them, and if there were easy ones, I'm sure you'd already have it. But just want to open ourselves up to the conversation and encourage you, man. Thanks for what you're doing.
Okay, and at this time, we have no further questions on the phone.
Thank you to our speakers and all of the participants for joining the call today. Please visit restoreyourvote.org for more information on the issue. If you're a member of the public and have additional questions or would like more information, please email us at info@campaignlegal.org. If you're a member of the media and would like additional information, please email media@campaignlegal.org. Thank you all again, and have a good afternoon.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for joining. You may now disconnect.